The other thing was that in your Perkin Medal address, you made an interesting comment, which I'd like to bring in here and keep in mind as we go on. You said that researchers trying to find new catalysts have an attitude that catalysis is too complex for a fundamental understanding, and workers trying to find a fundamental understanding of catalysis are not necessarily driven by a desire to find a new catalyst.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that much is to be gained when you do both, which is what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
And would you say you were unique at that time? Your counterparts in other companies were not doing that?
Well, I'd hate to say I was unique, but I think the tradition, what I was getting at in the Perkin Medal address there was that that was a traditional way of looking at things, that people who were developing catalysts, as I said, in general thought that this is a very general statement. That doesn't mean there weren't some people out there in other or industrial organizations who were interested in fundamental work. But by and large, people tended to go into two camps. As I said, there would be people developing catalysts and not being primarily concerned with the mechanism of kinetics of reactions. And many of them would even go to the extreme of saying, it's a waste of time. Don't bother me with this stuff. I mean,
you say they had an Edisonian approach, something off the shelf and try.
I hate to use those words, too, because one thing I'm sensitive about is the words Edisonian and empirical. I mean, Edison's fine. I think you can do. I think there are a lot of people who would love to be Thomas Edison. Would like to have the accomplishments he had, and the word empirical is another one that I think it's overused, because all science is empirical in my mind. I mean, that's the way chemistry developed. That's the way most things develop. And then the word empirical has the idea of building. To build, that's the way science evolves. I think that's why history of science, as I was saying earlier, is so important, that these things don't evolve in the most logical way. They aren't pre-programmed. That you build up a collection of facts, and observation is very important in chemistry. And when I'm talking about that there's a group of people out there who are identified with developing catalysts and not being interested in mechanism or kinetics, I'm not downgrading those people. Some of the best people out there were those people, and they've got the facts to prove it, whether it's intuition or whatever you want to call it. It's just that they have a very different attitude from another group of people who's oriented toward understanding mechanism, kinetics, and so on. So a while back, maybe the only people who might have been interested in the fundamental aspects of heterogeneous catalysis might have been people in academia, and maybe very few people in industrial organizations. Well, I do remember one person at Shell, for example, who went back to the World War II days and prior to that, who was interested in a more fundamental approach. It was a man named Otto Bake. He's dead. He died well around the early 50s. But he was interested in fundamental studies of catalysts, and he had a program going even before World War II out in the Emeryville labs at Shell. There were people in Universal Oil Products, a few of them, who were very much oriented that way, too. Louis Schmerling was one that I can remember, who was very much interested in the mechanisms of acid-catalyzed reactions, carbocation chemistry in general. You can't group all these people into industry or into academic camps. But I just wanted to point out that there were these two camps, but I didn't see anything wrong with trying to be a part of both camps. As a matter of fact, that was the point I was making, and I thought there could be real advantages. And where I see the advantage isn't necessarily that having a fundamental attitude about things is necessarily going to lead to a new catalyst or a new discovery of a process. That might happen, by the way. That could happen. But it might not either. But science, in the way I see it, is frequently most useful when you get to the development stages of a project. In other words, oftentimes it's been my experience that where science is important is not in the initial discovery, it's in doing something with a discovery once you've made it. Because I often see situations where discoveries will have been made and where things have fallen by the wayside because the science wasn't followed up. People didn't try to understand more what they were doing, and something was transferred from very initial discovery stage to a development stage without a proper understanding of some of the things that were important in the process. And so I think that's what I was getting at in the Perkin Medal address, that I think trying to be part of both camps has its advantages, because if you do make a discovery, then you're going to have the attitude about it, gee, I'd like to understand this better. And I can show you some real good examples in the case of catalysts. You study the structure of the catalyst. You find out how that structure, whether it's going to be stable at the conditions at which you run a commercial operation. You get in with whatever tools you can apply, spectroscopy, chemical probes of all sorts. You try to understand. And then it's been my experience that it's been actually critical in a couple of cases where we have found out something very important from an X-ray diffraction pattern, which told us how the heck we're going to have to process this catalyst, otherwise we're going to just knock ourselves out completely.
Okay.
That's what I was really driving at. So, and I think that this is something that educators should also become or recognize more. That it isn't always that science means it isn't always that you got to do good science to make a discovery. That might happen, because discovery could happen in lots of ways. But where science will invariably be important is in doing the right thing with the discovery once you've made it. And I'm positive science will be important there.
That's a very good point. Before we leave this early six-year period, we're around 1960 right now, you indicate on one of the forms that you filled out for us that a person of influence during this time was a colleague in catalysis.
Michel Boudard?
Right.
That's another person. It's time to bring him up, definitely. When I reported for work in 1954 at the Process Research Division of Standard Oil Development Company, there was a fellow by the name of Michel Boudard, who was born in Belgium in 1924, who was just down the road a piece, down Route 1 at Princeton University. He had been a student of U. Scott Taylor. And Michel is, I guess, 6 or 7 years older than I am. And I met him within a few months after I joined the company in the Process Research Division. How did I happen to meet him? He just happened to be up here. He'd made a contact with somebody in the company. It might have been Jack Longwell, I don't know, or Don Bader. Might have been the original contact. But at any rate, Michel was just beginning his first term as an assistant professor at Princeton at the same time I was becoming a researcher at the Standard Oil Development Company. So I met Michel, and somehow Michel happened to get a copy of my PhD thesis. I think what had happened was that Don Bader, I believe, was the person who was in another part of the process division working. And when I first came to work, we got talking about my thesis somehow. And Don was interested in it. And so I brought my thesis in, and Don, I guess, must have read the thesis. And Michelle was up here one day, and he happened to see the thesis, he got together with me through Don Bader, and he asked me if I would come to Princeton to give a seminar on my PhD thesis, which I did. That was the year that Einstein died, by the way. Turned out to be early 1955. I went down there within a few days of the time that Einstein died to give this seminar at Princeton. I remember that very well. And so I was just starting in catalysis, whereas Michel already had a big jump on me by about 5 or 6 years of experience with Hugh Scott Taylor in this field. And so one thing led to another, and Michel had organized a seminar on catalysis at Princeton, which he was kind enough to organize for Saturday mornings so that some industrial people could attend. So I religiously went down to Saturday morning seminars on catalysis at Princeton. That's where I met Sir Hugh Taylor. And Taylor was at all those seminars, and Michelle gave a number of them. And so I got a lot of background information on catalysis in those days. And then when I started to work on the kinetics, Michel is a superb kineticist. He's one of the world's great kineticists, I think, and he's certainly in the area of heterogeneous catalysis. And when I got interested in kinetics, we began talking about some of the things that I found, and Michel was getting interested in some of the results of our kinetic work, and he was involved with meetings and setting up meetings in the outside, invited me to present papers at some of these meetings around about 1960. And by that time, Michel had developed a relationship with the company where he spent a couple of summers actually working with the company as a summer employee. And he did some work on catalysts on reforming catalysts and their characterization with adsorption measurements, which were quite important in the early days. So we developed a relationship, and he eventually became a consultant here in the company. He's spent about, I guess, close to 40 years in a consulting relationship with Exxon. And so we've become very close over the years. We discuss all kinds of problems in the catalysis, very much aware of each other's work. He left Princeton about 1961 to go to the University of California, Berkeley. He was there 3 years, and then he transferred to Stanford. And he spent the rest of his career at Stanford. He retired last June. I was there at the retirement symposium. I presented a talk at the symposium in his honor. And this fall, he's spending a sabbatical at Caltech. He'll now be a professor emeritus there at Stanford, and I guess maybe do some writing. And he's no longer going to do research. He's not going to maintain an active laboratory. He's 70 now. But he may continue to collaborate with some people and so on. But it's been a long association, very close friends. And I would have to bring him right in there then with Harry Drickamer. As I said, Harry Drickamer was very important to me in my student days, getting me really oriented toward what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And then after I actually reported for work, Michel Boudard came along and provided a second component there. In other words, was somebody for me to talk with, because there weren't that many people interested in kinetics of catalytic reactions and industrial organization at that time, and so Michel was somebody that I could talk a lot with, and it meant an awful lot to me in the early stages of my career.
Well, here you are in the early 1960s. You've got a mandate from the president, Murphree, saying we need more fundamental research, and you created this exploratory group.
Yeah, I didn't create it. It was the company, right. The division created it, and I was asked to be part of this.
How many people were put into that originally?
At the time I would have been there, I don't know, maybe there might have been 10, 12 people or something like that.
Okay.
It's hard for me to, but it's, then the next big increase would have been, the next big factor that was the development of the Central Basic Research Lab, which happened relatively quickly after that, which was a separate laboratory then. It was no longer part of the Process Research Division. And that laboratory grew up to something like maybe 30-some people. And in the Central Basic Research Lab, I was not immediately part of that. At first, it was oriented primarily toward chemicals kinds of issues in the company rather than fuels. Because we had the exploratory section in the process division, I had this group on catalysis for fuels processes in the process division, so the CBRL, the Central Basic Lab, largely concentrated on chemicals types of things. Well, I was in that exploratory section in process research for maybe 6 years or so. And the process division was eventually broken up, the division in Bailey. Now, you may ask, why is this done? Because this was a very successful division, very successful for the development of process and so on. Well, there were a couple of factors. We had another laboratory doing process development work in Baton Rouge. So there were sort of two laboratories doing similar kinds of things, not working on the same problems, but the same general kind of activity. And we had a bad strike here at the Bayway Refinery in 1964. That was the year of the Goldwater-Johnson presidential election. I don't know whether the strike has anything to do with that. I just happened to mention that. But since some of the research company people were actually working in the refinery, that including me, our laboratories are inside the refinery, we had trouble with access to the refinery for about 3 or 4 months. And there were some problems about the picket lines and so on, so after a couple of very uncomfortable weeks about gaining access to the refinery in situations which could have been pretty hostile, they decided that they didn't want any more part of this, and they told us to report for work over in across the highway, building one where the research center was located. So we did that for several months, and it wasn't long after that they decided to do away with the Process Research Division altogether. Now, as I said, I don't know the ultimate reason for that, but the strike certainly didn't help that. Didn't help the Process Research Division remaining in Bayway. It might have been largely that they wanted to consolidate process development work in the Baton Rouge laboratories and take activities like the one I was involved in and put them in this central basic research lab that they had already set up largely for chemicals kinds of interests. And so here was a group that I would be bringing in would be catalysis directed toward fuels type of problems. But then when I got into CBRL, I gradually got interested in some chemicals problems too, because it was a long-range heterogeneous catalysis type of effort. If you want to, this time it might be well for me to make the point that Central Basic Research Lab, then I was transferred there in I think it was 1966, and then I might have operated in that laboratory for a couple of years as an entity, and it was decided at some point there we got to increase the scope by a step change in Exxon. Now take this central basic lab and go to something new, bigger than this. And the significant thing that happened in 1968 was that they decide to do away with the central basic research lab and replace it with a corporate research laboratory. The new feature of this was the funding. Corporate research lab was now to be funded by the central corporation, the Exxon Corporation. Prior to that, all the research had been funded by the affiliates. You see, the Exxon Corporation is a holding company, basically, and there are many, many affiliates worldwide. And say, Humble Oil and Refining Corporation, today Exxon USA, is one affiliate. And Imperial would be an affiliate, and there would be affiliates in Europe and the Far East and so on. And the affiliates then would have been the people who supplied the funds supporting the research. So prior to the corporate research laboratory, your research could be it's subject to the interest of the affiliates. Okay. So you see, you're going to have all the competing interests of different affiliates and so on determining what you're going to be doing your research on. Well, the new feature then was that the corporation itself was going to fund this rather than the affiliates, and now then you're not subject to, say, the interests of one affiliate relative to another one. You had a more general interest of the corporation developing new options for the corporation in general, and the corporation would be funding this directly. And the size of the laboratory then very quickly increased sharply. In corporate, we got up to a level of 100 or so people in the 70s, and then in the latter part of the 1970s, Ed David had become president of the Exxon Research and Engineering Company, and they decided that we might have another expansion in corporate research, and we ought to move the facility out here to Annandale.
Okay. Well, at this point, the early 1960s, you've already been successful with your kinetic studies, and that's been a great asset to the company. What do you do for an encore? Where do you go from here?
Well, what happened was, in the early 1960s, when I was first transferred to the exploratory section of process research, I embarked on a personal research program with bimetallic catalysts, alloy catalysts, and so on. Why did I get interested in this? Well, I wasn't the first one to ever get interested in an alloy catalyst. That I want to make clear immediately. There was a prominent industrial catalyst out there known as Rainey Nickel, which Merritt Rainey had a patent on, which is a nickel aluminum alloy, and that had been used for hydrogenation for some time. There had been people in the fundamental aspects of catalysis had been interested in alloys to study the so-called electronic factor in catalysis. This went back to, actually, there were a few investigations on this before World War II. That's how far back that went. But it became a very popular activity just shortly after World War II. People had the idea that some of the ideas of solid-state physics were becoming were coming into the catalysis community, and the ideas of band theory of solids and so on had been developed, and the semiconductors and all this sort of thing had come along, and people catalytic chemists had this idea about the electronic factor, that if I took a group 8 metal like nickel or platinum, where you have an incompletely filled D band. In other words, the isolated atom will have it'll have vacant D states. The metal will have some vacancies in the D band in the condensed system. Whereas a metal like copper, a non-transition metal, or gold or silver, will have a completely filled D band. And this means, this you can see in their magnetic properties. If you take a metal like nickel, it's very dramatic because it has some vacancies in the D band. It's ferromagnetic. Whereas copper would have no vacancies in the D band. It does not have any. It doesn't exhibit any ferromagnetism. So the idea that went all the way back to Mott in the 1935, he was a solid-state physicist, was if I took a nickel-copper alloy, that the copper could serve as an electron donor to the nickel, and that you could fill the D-band of the nickel and ultimately render it non-ferromagnetic. Well, actually, experimental data actually showed that. The experimental data actually were available before Mott made the proposal. But by the time you got 60% copper and nickel, it becomes non-ferromagnetic anymore. So that meant you have a filled D band, no D vacancies. Well, some people had the idea that, well, maybe this is important in catalysis, because the good catalysts were usually metals like nickel, platinum, palladium, all of which had incompletely filled D bands. In other words, their D orbitals, if you will, were not filled up. And that they would be markedly better than, say, a metal like copper, silver, or gold for, say, the hydrogenation of an olefin or the dehydrogenation of a cyclohexane or something like that. And so the idea said, well, suppose we studied an alloy as we add copper in. If this thinking is true, when we get to the point where we fill the D band up, we ought to lose our catalytic activity pretty abruptly. So that happened to be a theme that researchers got interested in, and I can't tell you how many investigations were done on that shortly after World War II, but all done with the same thing in mind. They were done with either nickel-copper system or the palladium-gold system, which is a very similar system. And the idea was to take a reaction like the hydrogenation of ethylene to ethane or H2D2 exchange, or ortho-para-hydrogen conversion, something like that, and study the reaction and try to determine whether this picture was true. And there are all kinds of investigations out there, all kinds of disagreements in data, and it turned out to be a complete mess. And it was very hard to be conclusive after all this work was done over a period of, particularly in the 50s. By the time 1960 rolled around, an awful lot of work had been done, and people were becoming disillusioned with it. So that didn't say there wasn't an electronic factor in catalysis. There certainly has to be. I mean, all chemistry is electronic. What it was saying was that alloys of this type apparently weren't going to be the best way of getting at this problem. Okay, so I come along now, and I'm interested in alloys. So the first question you might have, are you crazy? What do you want to get involved in this mess for? Well, the first thing I said to myself is, I don't want to work on the electronic factor in catalysis. Why? I don't know how to do it. And there was good reason for that. There are a lot of other guys out there showed that they didn't either. Okay, and so what's left? Well, this shows you something about research and why I think it being an industry can sometimes be an advantage in research. All the effort was directed toward one single problem with the alloys. Could we take a chemical reaction and correlate the catalytic activity with the composition of the alloy in some way that relates to this electronic effect? I mean, you're almost blinded toward it. That was the only thing you could do with an alloy. Nobody asked the question, if I put a big molecule over this thing that could do a lot of different things, like dehydrogenate or crack down the middle, will it matter whether, will the alloy affect its choice of which reaction path it wants to take? In other words, and that's a good example, like, will the molecule dehydrogenase as opposed to crack a carbon-carbon bond? That question hadn't been investigated. So that's simple. I know how to do that. I just get a hot tube and I pass this molecule through and see what happens. And it's going to be a molecule that's big enough to know some chemistry. I don't mean that ethylene doesn't know any chemistry, but there's not much it can do. It can hydrogenate to ethane, or hydrogen and deuterium can go to HD, or ortho-para-hydrogen. There's not many choices they have. But if I pass normal heptane over, heptane can go to toluene, it can go to methyl heptanes, it can crack into C3 and C4 and to C5 and C2, can do an awful lot of things. So the first experiment I made was to take nickel copper and something like heptane over it, and found an enormous effect